This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamotu, MPR.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us...
Helen Hegarty.
Andy Asquith.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Now, Andy and Iola, you both have an interest in local government, and there's just been a review released recently, I believe.
The Minister has announced a review that will present its final report in 2023. And it's the first root and branch examination of local government since the major reforms of 1989.
Root and branch examination.
It's the first fundamental review of local government's purpose, its scope, its scale. It will be a very comprehensive review. There have been sort of part reviews in the past. For instance, the last Labour government commissioned a review of local government finance, and also commissioned put in place a commission on Auckland governance. But this is the first examination of local government that will be nationwide and be comprehensive.
Okay, so were there any changes coming from the previous reviews you mentioned?
The Shan review was simply ignored, which was a great pity because it offered a number of practical solutions to help to tackle probably the biggest issue that local government faces in terms of finance. And the Royal Commission on Auckland Governance was essentially cherry-picked by the government of the day. It's worth noting that the commission was put in place by the previous Labour government and reported after the general election in 2008 when we had a national government. And the local government minister, Rodney Hyde, was, shall we say, not overly sympathetic towards local government and what it represented.
So what were the problems? Why were these reviews needed?
Well, in terms of Shand, the Shand inquiry was put in place because local government finance is a hot potato. Local government has been given an increasing range of functions to perform that have been delegated by central government without the funding streams to support these activities. And
So the review is a way of avoiding the political debate, or?
Well, the Shand review was to look at practical solutions to deal with local government's issues. And part of those problems which still exist is that each local authority would have its own little idiosyncrasies in terms of how it manages its finance. So if you go back and look at Shand came up with, I think, 96 recommendations of best practice that if there'd been if councils had been forced to accept Shand recommendations, then lots of the funding issues that are still evident today would have, in part at least, been addressed.
What, they'd have got more money, or they would have done less activities?
Well, I think the way that they generated their incomes would have been more diverse, and they'd have been financially more viable. At the moment, councils get the bulk of their income through rates, which is can be a problem for some councils. So the idea was to make the funding base more diverse, and also elements in terms of treasury management there as well, and how money is invested and used. One of the big issues that we have across local government is a general lack of best practice being shared.
So best practice is having diverse funding sources such as...
Well, best practice is learning from what other councils are doing. The problem is far too many councils in New Zealand are insular. There's lots of NIMBYism that exists. It's very parochial.
So what other sources of income are that they could have?
Well, they do have funding, competitive funding from the government, will say things like cycleways and pathways that they... But the problems I see with those is you get the money to do these things, but there's no money for maintenance or upkeep or any that sort of thing. That then falls back to the ratepayer.
Well, it does... Many councils are responsible for infrastructure, but there's no sort of funding that comes from the centre to help support that. There's a reluctance in many places for things like shared services that could provide different funding regimes for services.
Shared you mean like shared services, so you commuter got, access into Wellington and the local authorities, you mean? Authorities combining together to provide something.
Right, together. Before you had the Auckland amalgamation, the best example that is probably there was the Auckland Library Service. That was a pan-Auckland service. And it provided a good model as to how things could be done on an Auckland-wide basis. Before amalgamation, each council had its own department for this, department for that, and that was duplicated next door.
Yeah.
And next door. So you had two sort of chief planner, each place had its own chief planner, across all the councils. So on
the same principle, then, doesn't it mean it'd be better, instead of having all the local authorities, all those decision-making centralised, and you have one decision-maker for the whole country?
I suppose the answer to that is yes and no, because you can go down that road, but then you take... Does it matter who provides the service and who makes the decision? This is, there's a distinction here.
So you let the local people make the decisions as long as they all make the same decision?
Well, no. Don't be facetious, Stuart. You don't have to have the same level of service in each area. So you don't have to have a uniform service. But you can have the same service provider who can provide, within one council area, three libraries, another council area, 13 libraries. But that level of provision is determined by, in terms of local need, and local need is best determined by local councillors. Because they're, in theory, the people that are on the ground and are in touch with the community. But one of local government's main failings is... I would query the level of connectivity between many councillors and the majority of the community. Yeah. And that is best illustrated by turnout in local council elections. And that's on the decline. And one of my big bugbears here is no one seems overly bothered about this. You have silly situations. I've been told off the record by... I've lost count on the number of mayors and councillors that low turnout is a reflection of satisfaction. That people only vote when they're bothered about something, they're dissatisfied. Now, in Palmerston North, in 2019, the mayor went on the public record and said that. Now, I have seen no evidence from anywhere that supports that argument. It's a Trumpian claim. And a fundamental fact is that within New Zealand, I think there was only one mayor in 2019 who was supported by 50% plus one of people who voted. So most mayors in New Zealand are elected by a small minority of the population. So in Palmerston North, I think the mayor in 2019 received I think it was less than 15% of those who could vote voted for him.
Those who could vote, yeah.
Yeah. So that means that 85% of the population didn't vote for him.
And a lot of those didn't vote for anybody.
It doesn't matter, they didn't vote for the person who calls themselves the mayor.
Yeah, which probably meant they were indifferent. To speak it for didn't everyone. Matter to them, yeah.
But the question is, why were they indifferent? And, you know, neither the mayor and in Palmerston know that no one on council has questioned the mayor on this. You know, there seems to be institutional complacency about sort of decreasing turnout, and no one seems to be wholly sort of bothered.
So how would you increase the turnout? You stood in these elections.
I stood in those elections, and I stood purposely to try and increase the turnout.
And yet it went down. So do you think maybe you put a lot of voters off?
It's quite possible, but in a liberal democracy, elections are meant to be contested.
Oh, yes.
And the idea that I was going to turn it round in a single election was nonsense. It's something that is generational. It's going to take 20 years to get on top of this. Mm. And
might it be something to do with the way politics is actually taught? Because I've seen things coming out of ministries on teaching about politics and for school kids how to get involved in political processes. And it was something like, think of an issue that is important to you, gather around some friends so that they think it's important, make some posters and go and protest.
It's not about politics.
Nothing to do with learning about policies and issues and what can be done.
It's about civics, and it's about the roles and responsibilities of being a member of a civil society. And you know, for the last 20 odd years, well, the last 40 years, we've been fixated with the idea of me, me, me. And no one's given two hoots about society in its wider collective sense.
We're not even post-COVID, really, but we got to the stage of vaccines and so on now. But do you think that has given a lesson to people that there is a collective interest that has been overlooked?
Well, it's only a lesson if it's reinforced. Mm. And the problem is, it won't be, because we'll revert back to type. Mm. And
you think even in countries that have been in lockdown for over 12 months?
Well, it depends which country it is, isn't it? You know, look at Britain. You know, Britain has been in a complete mess, but Britain keeps, for some reason, keeps sort of re-electing Tory politicians. And I think, unfortunately, the idea of the team of 5 million will soon evaporate, because we will go back to the idea of it's all about me.
Yeah. Well, even now, the amount of scanning with the app showing where you've been, that's dropped right up.
Oh, it's dropped right. It's just amazing watching people walk into supermarkets and ignore the QR code. Mm. It's frightening. And but to go back to the question, how do we get people to vote? Well, it's about teaching civics in schools and about the importance and the privilege of voting. And one of the things that I bang on about a lot is New Zealand is one of only 24 countries in the world that's classed as a true full democracy. And yet the government has made not a song and dance about this at all. But if 15 fellas put black shirts on and run around the rugby field, then we get all excited and it's important. Mm. Now, I'm sorry if this is very un-New Zealandy, but it's not important. But democracy and freedom of speech, and the fact that I can sort of critique the government if I want without fear of a knock on the door in the middle of the night, is important.
Well, when you get MPs or ex-MPs saying that really, given that votes in Parliament most of them, they're the party vote, so there's a block vote for the party, so a load of MPs aren't individually making decisions on the issues, so you just have a small number of key politicians who could be making
But now we're into a much bigger picture, aren't we? If you go back to when John Key was Prime Minister, now I'm no fan of John Key at all, but fairly early on in his first term, he talked about setting up a constitutional convention to look at the constitution of New Zealand, because New Zealand is one of those countries that doesn't have a formal written constitution. And from memory, he appointed Michael Cullen as a chair of this.
Because Geoffrey Palmer was interested in something like that, wasn't he?
Yeah, and the whole commission sort of fell over and died a death. But it was going to look at things like a Bill of Rights, written constitution. One of the weaknesses of New Zealand in terms of government is the fact that we have what's called a unicameral parliament.
In one house.
Just a single chamber. And there are very few countries that just have a single chamber. Most countries, most Western countries, have two chambers. The second chamber provides sort of a check on the first, on the lower chamber. So in the UK, you've got the House of Commons, and then you've got the House of Lords. In the United States, you've got the House of Representatives, and you've got the Senate.
Yeah. And the President is...
If you just talk about
the whole general idea of checks and balances on that.
Yes. And in New Zealand, you don't have that. And if you go back to the 60s in the UK, there's a politician called Lord Hailsham who talked about the elected dictatorship. And he was talking then about if you have a House of Commons, it's the lower chamber in the UK, where you have a government that has a majority, it's very difficult to stop it pushing through any legislation that it wants. The House of Lords can check and can delay, but it can't stop. But within New Zealand, you haven't got that fundamental safety mechanism. Now, for a long time, we argued that MMP provided that safety mechanism because it was virtually impossible for a single-party government to exist.
Well, even before then, they said that there's one safety mechanism in that with a three-year term, if you can push whatever things through that you want while you're in office, but you can be thrown out after 3 years. So,
but that is a fundamental failing in it, hasn't it? In the fact that you can abolish the election in 3 years' time.
I think you'd have some problems doing that.
I don't think you would. If you have a majority, you could push it through, and there's nothing that could stop that going through. The only thing that stops it is constitutional convention that says that that's not how we do things, and this is, you know, and that there's certain laws in place, and we abide by the laws. But all you want is a maverick politician who becomes prime minister. You know, someone like that clown in Brazil. Or Trump, and they just do what they want and disregard the law and convention. And that's a fundamental weakness in New Zealand. So back to how you get people to vote. Well, you teach civics in schools, you change the way in which councillors operate and which councillors are elected.
In what way?
Well, there's a wonderful quote from Yes Prime Minister where Jim Hacker's talking about councillors and says no one knows who they are or what they do, and councillors know this.
Mm-hmm.
He's talking about councillors in the UK, but that quote is applicable here as it is there.
Yeah, because I think you mentioned to me before one of the big things for getting elected is name recognition.
It's all about popularity and recognition. There was work done in New Zealand in the 80s by a guy called Graham Bush in the University of Auckland. And Graham illustrated that the best way to be elected as a councillor is to be an incumbent. But you've got to try really, really hard not to get re-elected.
Yeah.
And the other ways to be elected are to have a name. So if you're a former All Black and you stand, you'll be elected. If you've been on telly, you'll be elected.
Up to a point, there's the idea, if you've just been elected, you've got, you know, it's going to take you some time to learn the ropes. So really, for someone to be an effective councillor, they probably have to have had one or two times.
There's a difference between being elected and being effective.
Yes, to some extent, they need experience before they can be effective.
But then you can ask yourself the question, and this is getting into deeper stuff, is how much power does a councillor have?
Well, very little to start with, presumably.
Well, very little full stop, I would argue. But then you go back again, you go back to the 1989 reforms, and you look at where the power sits within a local authority. And one of the big urban myths in New Zealand that many mayors subscribe to, unfortunately, and most of the population do, is that the mayor's a powerful person. And you look at the 89 reforms, and the power balance in councils was fundamentally redrawn, and all the power sits with the chief executive.
So, okay, could you illustrate that, or you know, in what way was it done to shift the power to the chief executive?
Well, traditionally, in public administration 101, is you have a balance, you have a partnership between the officials, in this case, the chief executive, and the politicians. And the perception in the 1980s was that that arrangement had led to the general economic and social malaise in New Zealand. The answer to all New Zealand's problems was to adopt ideas and practices from the private sector. Mm-hmm. So a very simple sort of view was developed that if something is in the public sector, it's bad, it's inefficient.
Public sector inefficient, private sector faces competition, so they have to be efficient.
Yeah, a really simplistic, childish sort of analogy was drawn. Mm. And unfortunately, too many politicians signed up to it. Mm. And what the public sector needed, and local government was part of this, was it needed a big infusion of private sector whiz, know-how, entrepreneurialism, and under the cliches you can
think. You're talking basically about, would it be neoliberalism?
Yeah. And to the legislation that was put in place in 1989, essentially give all the power within the local authority to the chief executive. Mm. So the council appoints a chief executive. Yeah. He or she is the only employee, which we're talking about the calibre of councillors. Yeah, most councillors wouldn't know that they only employ one person.
And before that, that wasn't the case?
That wasn't the case.
Okay.
And the chief executive has the job of implementing the policy that the council puts in place. Hmm. But everything is shrouded in... we're back to your language situation again. In fluffy language that...
Well, what is it that supposedly the elected representatives, they have the sort of governance role of broad direction, and then the chief executive and the employees doing the administration?
The councillors have got a dual role. On the one hand, it's the representative role, your voice. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, they have this governance role. What's happened in New Zealand, and Gene Drage wrote a book, crikey, over 10 years ago now, called The Balancing Act, that looked at how these two roles sit side by side. And what she found was that councillors, once they're elected, they get sucked into the governance role. And that essentially means they're bombarded with paper. Hmm. It just ties them up. That means that they can't fulfil their representative role. Councillors that do try and say, hang on a minute, I was elected to represent the people, they just get frozen out because they're not playing the game. And
so the governance role doesn't involve sort of putting in what they think is the will of the people and so on in terms of choosing direction?
It has on a very, very minor role. If you go to a council meeting here and see the amount of stuff on the agenda... It's paperwork that councils are flooded with, just to keep them busy and quiet.
Mm. The Yes Prime Minister thing, you fill up the red boxes hide the important stuff at the bottom.
Yeah, it's Yes Prime Minister stuff all the way. And you bounce them on the night before a meeting. Mm. You know, over a year ago, I think it was, there was an issue here in Palmerston North when the night before a committee meeting, the chief executive dropped a report on councillors about councillor expenses. Something that was highly sensitive, and the night before it gets dropped on them.
And they're not in a position to say, this has come too late, we'll discuss it at the next meeting?
Well, what they did foolishly was they said, oh, we'll convene a workshop. Mm-hmm. So something that should have been discussed in a transparent environment, which it would have been if it had been discussed on that day.
Without them having had time to read it.
Oh, well, there's two issues here. One is the fact that they were bounced at the last minute. That was wrong.
Yeah.
But they then dealt with a wrong by by another ROM by saying that we'll have a private workshop.
Yeah. So they couldn't just have said, we'll discuss it at the following meeting, not this meeting.
That's what they should have done and could have done.
Okay.
But this feeds back in to the idea of why people don't vote, don't engage. Because if councils keep having private workshops, then people are excluded.
Hmm.
And also, I think talking workshops, some councils do actually have the public come to. And this was suggested with one of these previous reviews that this should happen. But, you know, Palmerston chose not
even if
to.
It's happened, probably the public wouldn't turn up. Or you get a few key members of the public who turn up.
Yes, people interested in particular
things. But this fits into the narrative, doesn't it? That it's three people like us, nice, white, middle-class people, that go to these meetings and know what's happening.
And it's all our fault if it goes wrong. So you're better off staying away, is that?
Well, but why?
I had nothing to do with it.
Why is it people like us that always do this stuff?
This is part one of two. Listen next week for part two. Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website. And a range of programmes is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.mpr.nz/donate.